Beta Castro suspected all this with a high degree of certainty.
First thing, from Pam.
Blonde and sardonic, Eric's child Pam was as close to a friend as I had among the vamps. I nodded, signaling Mustafa to deliver the message.
She says, tell Suki that this is the hard time that will show what she is made of.
I cocked my head. No advice other than that? Not too helpful. I figured as much. I pretty much assumed Felipe's post-Victor visit would be a very touchy one, but that Pam would warn me seemed a bit odd.
Harder than you know, Mustafa said intently.
I stared at him, waiting for more. Maddeningly, he did not elaborate. I knew better than to ask him to.
The other thing is from me, he continued.
Only the fact that I'd had to control my face all my life kept me from giving him major doubtful. Mustafa giving me advice?
I'm a lone wolf, he said by way of preamble.
I nodded. He hadn't affiliated with the Shreveport werewolves, all members of the Longtooth Pack.
When I first blew into Shreveport, I looked into joining. I even went to a pack gathering, Mustafa said.
It was the first chink I'd seen in his I'm badass and I don't need anyone armor. I was startled that he'd even tried. Alcide Hervaux, the pack leader in Shreveport, would have been glad to gain a strong wolf like Mustafa.
The reason I didn't even consider it is because of Janilyn, he said.
Janilyn Hopper was Alcide's enforcer. She was about as big as a wasp, and she had the same nature. Because Janilyn's really tough and she would challenge someone as alpha as you, I said. He inclined his head.
She wouldn't leave me standing. She would push and push until we fought.
You think she could win? Over you? I made it not quite a question. With Mustafa's size advantage and his greater experience, I could not fathom why Mustafa had a doubt he would be the victor. He inclined his head again.
I do. Her spirit is big.
She likes to feel in charge? She has to be the baddest bitch in the fight?
I was in Hare the Dog yesterday, early evening, just to spend some time with the other wares after I got through working for the vamps, get the smell of Eric's house out of my nose. Though we got a debtor hanging around at the Hare lately. Anyway, Janilyn was talking to Alcide while she was serving him a drink. She knows you loaned Merlot some money to keep his bar afloat.
I shifted in my chair, suddenly uneasy. I'm a little surprised Sam told her, but I didn't ask him to keep it a secret.
I'm not so sure he did tell her. Janilyn's not above snooping when she thinks she ought to know something, and she doesn't even think of it as snooping. She thinks of it as fact-gathering. Here's the bottom line. Don't cross that bitch. You're on the borderline with her.
Because I helped Sam? That doesn't make any sense. Though my sinking heart told me it did.
Doesn't need to. You helped him when she couldn't, and that galls her. You ever seen her when she's got a mad on?
I've seen her in action. Sam always liked such challenging women. I could only conclude that she saved her softer, gentler side for him.
Then you know how she treats people she sees as a threat.
I wonder why Alcide hasn't picked Janilyn as his first lady, or whatever the term is, I said, just to veer away from the subject for a moment. He made her pack enforcer, but I would have thought he would pick the strongest female wolf as his mate.
She'd love that, Mustafa said. I can smell that on her. He can smell that on her. But she don't love Alcide, and he don't love her. She's not the kind of woman he likes. He likes women his own age, women with a little curve to them, women like you.
But she told Alcide... I had to stop because I was hopelessly confused. A few weeks ago, she advised Alcide he should try to seduce me, I said awkwardly. She thought I would be an asset to the pack.
If you're confused, think how Janilyn's feeling.
Mustafa's face might have been carved in stone.
She's got a relationship with Sam, but you were able to save him when she wasn't. She halfway wants Alcide, but she knows he wanted you too. She's big in the pack, and she knows you have pack protection. You know what she can do to people who don't.
I shuddered. She does enjoy the enforcement, I said. I've watched her. Thanks for the heads up, Mustafa. If you'd like a drink or something to eat, the offer still stands.
I'll take a glass of water, he said, and I got it in short order.
I could hear one of Dermot's rented power tools going above our heads in the attic, and though Mustafa cocked an eye toward the ceiling, he didn't comment until he'd finished his drink.
Too bad he can't come with you to Shreveport, he said then. Fairies are good fighters.
Mustafa handed me his empty glass.
Thanks, he said.
And then he was out the door. I mounted the stairs to the second floor as the motorcycle roared its way back to Hummingbird Road. I stood in the attic doorway. Dermot was shaving the bottom off one of the doors. He knew I was there, but he kept on working, casting a quick smile over his shoulder to acknowledge my presence. I considered telling him what Mustafa had just told me, simply to share my worries. But as I watched my great uncle work, I reconsidered. Dermot had his own problems. Claude had left with Niall, and there was no way of knowing when he'd return or in what condition. Until Claude's return, Dermot was supposed to make sure all was running smoothly at Hooligan's. What would that motley crew be capable of without Claude's control? I had no idea if Dermot could keep them in line or if they'd ignore his authority. I started to launch a boat full of worry about that, but I gave myself a reality check. I couldn't assume responsibility for Hooligan's. It was none of my business. For all I knew, Claude had a system in place, and all Dermot had to do was follow it. I could only worry about one bar, and that was Merlot's, kind of alternating with Fantasia. Okay, two bars. Speaking of which, my cell phone buzzed me to remind me we were getting a beer delivery that morning. It was time for me to hustle into work. If you need me, you call me, I told Dermot. With a proud air, as if he'd learned a clever phrase in a foreign language, Dermot said, You have a nice day, you hear? I took a hasty shower and pulled on some shorts and a Merlot's t-shirt. I didn't have time to blow-dry my hair completely, but at least I put on some eye makeup before I hustled out the door. It felt excellent to shed my supernatural worries and to fall back on thinking about what I had to do at Merlot's, especially now that I'd bought into it. The rival bar opened by the now-deceased Victor, Vic's Redneck Roadhouse, had taken a lot of customers away. To our relief, the newness of our rival was wearing off, and some of our regulars were returning to the fold. At the same time, the protests against patronizing a bar owned by a shapeshifter had stopped since Sam had started attending the church that had supplied most of the protesters. It had been a surprisingly effective countermove, and I am proud to say I thought of it. Sam had blown me off at first, but he'd reconsidered when he'd cooled off. Sam had been pretty nervous the first Sunday, and only a handful of people talked to him. But he kept it going, if irregularly, and the members were getting to know him as a person first, a shapeshifter second. I'd loaned Sam some money to float the bar through the worst time. Instead of repaying me bit by bit, as I'd imagined he would, Sam now regarded me as a part owner. After a long and cautious conversation, he'd upped my paycheck and added to my responsibilities. I'd never had something that was kind of my own before. There was no other word for it but awesome. Now that I handled some of the administrative work at the bar and Kennedy could come in as bartender, Sam was enjoying a little more well-earned time off. He spent some of it with Janilyn. He went fishing, a pastime he'd enjoyed with his dad and mom when he was a kid. Sam also worked on his double wide, inside and out, trimming his hedge and raking his yard, planting flowers and tomatoes in season, to the amusement of the rest of the staff. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was real nice that Sam liked to take care of his home, even if it was parked behind the bar. What gave me the most pleasure was seeing the tension ease out of his shoulders now that Merlot's was on an even keel again. I was a little early. I had the time to make some measurements in the storeroom. I figured if I had the right to accept beer shipments, I had the right to institute a few changes, too, subject to Sam's approval and consent, of course. The guy who drove the truck, Duff McClure, knew exactly where to put the beer. I counted the cases as he unloaded them. I'd offered to help the first time we'd dealt together, and Duff had made it clear it would be a cold day in hell before a woman helped him do physical work.
You've been selling more Michelob lately, he remarked.
Yeah, we got a few guys who've decided that's all they're gonna drink, I said. They'll be back to Bud Light before too long.
You need any True Blood?
Yeah, the usual case.
You got a regular vamp clientele.
Small, but regular, I agreed, my mind on writing the check for the shipment. We had a few days to pay it, but Sam had always paid on delivery. I thought that was a good policy.
They take 3-4 cases at Vic's, Duff said conversationally.
Bigger bar, I began writing the check.
I guess vamps are everywhere now.
Mm-hmm, I muttered, filling it out carefully. I was serious about my check-writing privileges. I signed with a flourish.
Even that bar in Shreveport, that one that turned out to be for werewolves, they take some blood drinks now.
Hair of the dog? Hadn't Mustafa mentioned a vamp who was hanging out at the werebar?
Yeah, I delivered there this morning.
Huh. This news was unsettling, but Husky Duff was a huge gossip, and I didn't want him to know he'd shaken me. Well, everybody's got to drink, I said easily. Here's your check, Duff. How's Dorothy? Duff tucked the check into the zippered pouch he kept in a locked box in the passenger floorboard.
She's good, he said with a grin. We're having another youngin', she says.
Oh my gosh, how many does that make?
This'll be number 3, Duff said, shaking his head with a rueful grin. They're gonna have to take out some college loans, do it themselves.
It'll be fine, I said, which meant almost nothing except that I felt goodwill toward the McClure family.
Sure thing, he said. Catch you next time, Sookie. I see Sam's got his fishing pole out. Tell him I said to catch some crappie for me.
When the truck had gone, Sam came out of the trailer and came over to the bar. You did that on purpose, I said. You just don't like Duff.
Duff's okay, Sam said. He just talks too much. Always has.
I hesitated a moment. He says they're stocking True Blood at the Hair of the Dog. I was treading on shaky ground.
Really? That's pretty weird.
I may not be able to read two-natured minds as easily as I can human minds, but I could tell Sam was genuinely surprised. Janilyn hadn't told him a vampire was coming into her bar, a were-bar. I relaxed. Come on in and let me show you something, I said. I've been in there measuring.
Uh-oh, you want to move the furniture?
Sam was half-smiling as he followed me into the bar. No, I want to buy some, I said over my shoulder. See here? I paced off a modest area just outside the storeroom. Look, right here by the back door, this is where we need us some lockers.
What for?
Sam didn't sound indignant, but like he genuinely wanted to know. So we women won't have to put our purses in a drawer in your desk? I said. So Antoine and Derek can keep a change of clothes here? So each employee will have their own little space to store stuff.
You think we need this?
Sam looked startled. So bad, I said. Now, I looked in a few catalogs and checked online, and the best price I found. We continued talking lockers for a few minutes, Sam protesting at the expense, me giving him all kinds of grief, but in a friendly way. After a token fuss, Sam agreed. I'd been pretty sure he would. Then it was 30 minutes till opening time, and Sam went behind the bar to start slicing lemons for the tea. I tied on my apron and began to check the salt and pepper shakers on the tables. Terry had come in very early that morning to clean the bar, and he'd done his usual good job. I straightened a few chairs. How long has it been since Terry had a race? I asked Sam, since the other waitress hadn't come in yet and Antoine was in the walk-in refrigerator.
2 years, Sam said. He's due, but I couldn't go giving raises until things got better. I still think we better wait until we're sure we're level.
I nodded, accepting his judgment. Now that I'd gone over the books, I could see how careful Sam had been in the good times, saving money up for the bad. India, Sam's newest hire, came in 10 minutes early, ready to hustle. I liked her more and more as I worked with her. She was clever at handling difficult customers. Since the only person who came in when we unlocked the front door at 11 was our most consistent alcoholic, Jane Bodehouse, India went back to the kitchen to help Antoine, who turned on the fryers and heated up the griddle. India was glad to find things to do while she was at work, which was a refreshing change. Kenya, one of our patrol officers, came and looked around inquiringly. You need something, Kenya? I asked. Kevin's not here. Kevin, another patrolman, was deeply in love with Kenya, and she with him. They ate lunch here at least once or twice a week.
My sister here? She told me she was going to be working today, Kenya asked.
Is India your sister? Kenya was a good 10 years older than India, so I hadn't put them together.
Half-sister? Yeah, our mother would get out the map when we were born,
Kenya said, kind of daring me to find that amusing.
She named us after places she wanted to go. My big brother's name is Spain. I got a younger one named Cairo.
She didn't stick to countries.
No, she threw in a few cities for good measure. She thought the word Egypt was too chewy. That's a direct quote.
Kenya was walking as she talked, following my pointed finger in the direction of the kitchen.
Thanks, Sookie.
The foreign names were kind of cool. Kenya's mom sounded like fun to me. My mom hadn't been a fun person, but then she'd had a lot to worry about after she'd had me. I sighed to myself. I tried not to regret things I couldn't change. I listened to Kenya's voice coming through the serving hatch, brisk and warm and clear, greeting Antoine, telling India that Cairo had fixed India's car and she should come by to pick it up when she got off work. I brightened when my own brother walked in just as Kenya was leaving. Instead of sitting at the bar or taking a table, he came up to me.
"You think I look like a Holland?"
I asked him, and Jason gave me one of his blankest stares.
"No, you look like a Sookie," he said. "Listen, Sook, I'm gonna do it."
"Gonna do what?" He looked at me impatiently. I could tell this wasn't how he'd expected the conversation to go.
"I'm gonna ask Michelle to marry me."
"Oh, that's great," I said with genuine enthusiasm.
"Really, Jason, I'm happy for you. I sure hope she says yes."
"This time I'm gonna do everything right," he said, almost to himself.
His first marriage had been a mistake from the start, and it had ended even worse than it had begun.
"Michelle's got a good head on her shoulders," I said.
"She's no kid," he agreed. "In fact, she's a little older than me, but she don't like me to bring that up."
"You won't then, right?
No jokes," I warned him.
He grinned at me.
"No jokes. And she's not pregnant, and she's got her own job and her own money."
None of these facts had been true of his first wife.
"Go for it, brother." I gave him a quick hug.
He flashed the grin at me, the one that had hooked scores of women.
"I'm asking her today when she gets off work. I was gonna eat lunch here, but I'm too nervous."
"Let me know what she says, Jason. I'll be praying for you."
I beamed at his back as he left the bar. He was as happy and nervous as I'd ever seen him. Merlot's began to fill up after that, and I was too busy to think much. I love being at work because I get to be around people and I know what's going on in Bon Ton. On the other hand, most of the time I know too much. It's a feathery balance between listening to people with my ears and not listening to them in my head, and it's not too surprising that I have a big rep for being eccentric. At least most people are too nice to call me Crazy Sookie anymore. I like to think I've proved myself to the community. Tara came in with her assistant, McKenna, to order an early lunch. Tara looked even bigger with her pregnancy than she had at Hooligan's the night before. Since she brought McKenna along, I couldn't ask Tara what I really wanted to know. What had happened when she talked to JB about his second job at Hooligan's? Even if he hadn't seen Tara in the crowd, he'd have to know we were going to tell her. But Tara was thinking about the shop with great determination, and when she wasn't planning to restock the lingerie counter, she was concentrating on the Merlot's menu, the very limited menu that she knew back and forth, trying to figure out what she could digest and how many more calories she could ingest without actually exploding. McKenna's brain wasn't any help. Though McKenna loved to know every little snippet of information about Bon Ton happenings, she didn't know about JB's moonlighting. She would have been vastly interested if I'd told her. McKenna would have loved to be a telepath for about 24 hours. But after she'd heard stuff like, "I can't take it anymore, I'm gonna wait till he's asleep and slash him," or "I'd like to take her and bend her over the bar and drive my..." Well, after a day or two of that, she wouldn't love it so much. Tara didn't even go to the ladies' room by herself. She towed McKenna along. I looked questioningly at Tara. She glared at me, not ready to talk, not yet. When the lunch rush was over, only two tables remained in use, and they were in India's section. I went back to Sam's office to work on the endless paperwork. Trees had died to make these forms, and that seemed a great pity to me. I tried to fill out anything I could online, though I was very slow at it.
Sam came back to his office to retrieve a screwdriver from his desk, so I asked him a question about an employee tax form. He was leaning over me to look at it when Janilyn walked in. "Hey, Janilyn," I said. I didn't even look at her because I'd identified her mental signature before she'd entered, and I was trying real hard to complete the form while Sam's instructions were still fresh in my mind.
"Oh, hey, Jan," Sam said.
I could feel his smile in his voice. Instead of a response, there was an ominous silence.
"What?" I said, filling in one more figure.
I finally looked up to see that Janilyn was in high offensive mode, her eyes round and wide, her nostrils dilated, her whole slim body tense with aggression.
"What?" I asked again, alarmed. "Are we being attacked?"
Sam remained silent. I swung around in the swivel chair to look up at him, and he was in a posture that was tense too, but his face was one big warning.
"You two want to be alone?"
I scrambled to get up and out from between them. "I would have thought so before I walked in," Janilyn said, her fists like little hammers.
"What? Wait, you thinking Sam and I are fooling around in the office?"
Despite Mustafa's warning, I was genuinely astonished.
"Honey, we are filling out tax forms. If you think there's anything sexy about that, you should get a job with the IRS.
There was a long moment when I wondered if I was going to get my ass kicked, but gradually the suspense ratcheted down. I did notice that Sam didn't say anything, not a word, until Janilyn's stance had completely relaxed. I took a deep breath.
"Excuse us for a minute, Sookie,"
Sam said, and I could tell he was really angry.
"Certainly."
I was out of that room as fast as a greased pig. I would have rather cleaned the men's room after a Saturday night than have stayed in Sam's office. India was helping Derek clear off a table. She glanced at me and half smiled.
"What lit your tail on fire?" she asked. "Sam's scary girlfriend?"
I nodded. "I'm just going to find something to do out here," I said. This was a very good opportunity to dust the bottles and shelves behind the bar, and I moved them all carefully, cleaning a bit of shelf and moving on to another one. Though I couldn't help but wonder what was going on in Sam's office, I reminded myself repeatedly that it wasn't my business. I had the bar as clean as a whistle by the time Janilyn and Sam emerged.
"Sorry," she said to me, with no particular sincerity.
I nodded in acknowledgement. Janilyn thought, "She'll get Sam if she can." "Oh, please," I thought. "She'd be real happy if I died." And then she left the bar, Sam following her to say goodbye, or to make sure she actually got in her car, or both. By the time he returned, I was so desperate for something to do, I was about to start counting the toothpicks in the clear plastic dispenser.
"We can get back on that paperwork tomorrow," Sam said in passing, and continued walking.
He avoided my eyes. He was surely embarrassed. It's always good to give people time to recover from that, especially guys, so I cut Sam some slack. A work crew from Norcross came in, their shift over, and some celebration in progress. India and I began putting tables together to accommodate all of them. While I worked, I thought about young shifter women. I'd encountered more than one who was very aggressive, but there were very few female pack leaders in the United States, especially in the South. An astounding few of the female wares I'd met were extremely vicious. I wondered if this exaggerated aggression was due to the established male power structure in the packs. Janilyn wasn't psychotic, as the Pelt sisters and Marnie Stonebrook had been, but she was uber-conscious of her own toughness and ability. I had to abandon theoretical thinking to get the drink orders right for the Norcross men and women. Sam emerged to work behind the bar, India and I began moving at a faster pace, and gradually everything settled back to normal. Just as I was about to get off work, Michelle and Jason came in together. They were holding hands. From Jason's smile, it was easy to see what her answer had been.
"Seems like we're going to be sisters," Michelle said in her husky voice, and I gave her a heartfelt hug.
I gave Jason an even happier one. I could feel his delight pouring out of his head, and his thoughts weren't so much coherent as a jumble of pleasure.
"Have you two had time to think about when it'll be?"
"Nothing's stopping us from having it soon," Jason said. "We've both been married already, and we don't go to church much, so there's no reason to have a church wedding."
I thought that was a pity, but I kept my mouth shut. There was nothing to gain and everything to lose by adding my 2 cents. They were grown-ups.
I might need to prepare Cork a little bit, Michelle said, smiling. I don't think he'll kick up a fuss over me remarrying, but I do want to break it to him gentle.
Michelle still worked for her former father-in-law, who seemed to have more regard for Michelle than he had for his lazy son.
So it'll be soon. I hope that it's okay if I come.
Oh, sure, Sook, Jason said and hugged me. We ain't eloping or anything. We just don't want a big church thing. We'll have a party out at the house afterward. Right, honey?
He deferred to Michelle.
Sure, she said. We'll fire up our grill. Maybe Hoyt can bring his over, too, and we'll cook whatever anybody brings. Another guest can bring drinks or whatever, vegetables and desserts. That way no one will worry and we'll all have a good time.
A potluck wedding. That was very practical and low-key. I asked them to let me know what I could bring that would be most helpful. After lots of mutual goodwill had been exchanged, they left, still holding hands and smiling. India said,
Another one bites the dust. How you feeling about this, Sookie?
I like Michelle real well. I'm so happy.
Sam called. They engaged?
Yeah,
I called back, a few happy tears in my eyes. Sam was making an effort to sound upbeat, though he was still a little worried about his own romantic situation. Any irritation I'd felt about the Janilyn episode simply melted away. Sam had been my friend for years, while significant others came and went. I went up to the bar and leaned against it.
Second time around for both of them. They're real good together.
He nodded, accepting my tacit reassurance that I wasn't going to bring up Janilyn's little outburst of jealousy.
Crystal was all wrong for your brother. Michelle is all right.
In a nutshell, I agreed. Since Holly called in to say her car wouldn't start, but Hoyt was working on it, I was still at Merlot's when JB came in about 10 minutes later. My friend, the secret stripper, was looking handsome and hearty as always. There's something about JB, something warm and simple that's really appealing, especially when added to his non-threatening good looks. He's like a great loaf of homemade bread.
Hey, friend, I said. What can I get for you?
Sookie, I saw you last night.
He waited for my big reaction.
I saw you too.
Just about every inch of him.
Tara was there,
JB told me, as though that would be news.
I saw her as she was leaving.
Uh-huh, I agreed. She was.
Was she mad?
She was real surprised, I said cautiously. Are you seriously telling me you all have not talked about last night?
I got in pretty late, he said. I slept out on the couch. When I got up this morning, she'd already gone to the store.
Oh, JB, I shook my head. Honey, you got to talk to her.
What can I say? I know I should have told her.
He made a hopeless gesture with his hands.
I just couldn't think of any other way to earn some extra money. Her shop's not doing so great right now, and I don't make a lot. We don't have good insurance. Twins! That's gonna be a big hospital bill. What if one of them's sick?
It was so tempting to tell him not to worry about it, but there was every reason for him to be concerned, and it would be patronizing to tell him he didn't need to be. JB had made a clever move for JB. He had found a way to use his assets to make extra money. His downfall had been in not informing his wife he was taking off his clothes in front of many other women on a weekly basis. We talked off and on while JB nursed a beer at the bar. Tactfully, Sam pretended to be so busy that he was deaf to our intermittent conversation. I urged JB to cook something special for Tara that night, or to stop off at Walmart and buy her a little bouquet. Maybe he could give her a foot rub and a back massage, anything to make her feel loved and special.
And don't tell her how big she is,
I said, poking a finger into his chest.
Don't you dare! You tell her she's more beautiful than ever now that she's carrying your children.
JB looked exactly as though he were going to say,
But that's not true.
He was sure thinking it. He met my eyes and clamped his lips shut.
Doesn't make any difference what the truth is. You say she looks great, I told him. I know you love her.
JB looked sideways for a minute, testing that statement for its truth value, and then he nodded.
I do love her, he said.
Then he smiled.
She completes me,
he said proudly. JB loved movies.
Well, you just complete her right back, I said. She needs to feel pretty and adored because she feels big and clumsy and uncomfortable,
It's not easy being pregnant, I hear.
I'll try, Sookie. Can I call you if she doesn't soften up?
Yeah, but I know you can work this out, JB. Just be loving and sincere, and she'll come around.
I like stripping, he said suddenly, as I was turning away.
Yeah, I know, I said.
I knew you would understand.
He took a last sip of beer, left Sam a tip, and went to work at the gym in Clarice.
This must be couples day, India said. Sam and Janilyn, Jason and Michelle, JB and Tara.
The thought didn't seem to make her particularly happy. You still dating Lola? Though I knew the answer, it was always better to ask.
No, it didn't work out.
I'm sorry, I said. Maybe someday soon the right woman will just walk in the door of the bar and you'll be all fixed up.
I hope so.
India looked depressed.
I'm not a fan of the wedding industry, but I sure would like a steady someone. Dating makes me all confused.
I never was any good at dating. That why you go with the vamp? To scare off everyone else? I love him, I said steadily. That's why I go with him. I didn't point out that human guys were simply impossible for me. You can imagine reading your date's mind every minute. No, it really wouldn't be any fun, would it?
No need to get all defensive, India said.
I thought I'd been matter of fact. He's fun, I said mildly, and he treats me nice.
They're... I don't know how to ask this, but they're cold, right?
India wasn't the first person who tried to find a delicate way to ask me that. There wasn't any delicate way. Not room temperature, I said. I left it at that, because any more was none of anyone else's business.
Damn,
she said after a moment. After a longer moment, she said,
Ew.
I shrugged. She opened her mouth, looked as though she wanted to ask me something else, and then she closed it. Fortunately for both of us, her table gestured that they wanted their bill, and one of Jane Boathouse's buddies came in drunk off her ass, so we both had things to do. Holly finally arrived to relieve me, complaining about her no-good car. India was working a double shift, so she kept her apron on. I waved a casual goodbye to Sam, glad to be walking out the door. I just made it to the library before it closed, and then I stopped by the post office to buy some stamps from the machine in the lobby. Hallie Belfleur was there on the same errand, and we greeted each other with real pleasure. You know how sometimes you just like someone, though you don't hang around with them? Hallie and I don't have much of anything in common, from our background to our educational level to our interests, but we like each other anyway. Hallie's baby bump was pronounced, and she looked as rosy as Tara looked wrecked.
How's Andy doing?
I asked.
He's not sleeping well. He's so excited about this baby, she said. He calls me from work to ask how I am and to find out how many times the baby kicked.
Sticking with Caroline?
Yeah, he was real pleased when I suggested that. His grandma brought him up, and she was a fine woman, if a little on the scary side.
Hallie smiled. Caroline Belfleur had been more than a little on the scary side. She'd been the last great lady of bon ton. She'd also been my friend Bill Compton's great-granddaughter. Hallie's baby would be 3 more greats away. I told Hallie about Jason's engagement, and she said all the right things. She was as polite as Andy's grandmother, and a hell of a lot warmer. Though it was good to see Hallie, when I got back into the car with my stamps, I was feeling a little blue. I turned the key in the ignition, but I didn't put the car in reverse. I knew I was a lucky woman in many respects, but there was life being created all around me, and I wasn't... I shut down that line of thought with a sharp command to myself. I would not start down the self-pity path. Just because I wasn't pregnant and wasn't married to someone who could make me that way, that was no reason to feel like an island in the stream. I shook myself briskly and set off to complete the rest of my errands. When I caught a glimpse of Faye DeLeon coming out of Grab It Quick, my attitude adjusted. Faye had been pregnant 6 times, and she was around my age. She told Maxine Fortenberry that she hadn't wanted the last 3, but her husband loved to see her pregnant, and he loved kids, and Faye allowed herself to be used like a puppy mill, as Maxine put it. Yes, attitude adjustment indeed. I had my evening meal and watched television and read one of my new library books that night, and I felt just fine all by myself every time I thought about Faye.
Chapter 3. There were no great revelations at work the next day, and not a single outstanding incident. I actually enjoyed that. I just took orders and delivered drinks and food, pocketing my tips. Kennedy Keyes was at the bar. I worried that she and Danny were still quarreling, though he might be at his other job at the home builder's supply place. Kennedy was subdued and dull, and I was sorry, but I didn't want to find out any more about her relationship problems. Anybody's relationship problems. I had enough of my own. It's a conscious effort to block out the thoughts of other people. Though I've gotten better at it, it's still work. I don't have to try as hard with a two-nature, because their thoughts are not as clear as human thoughts. I catch only a sentence or emotion here and there. Even among humans, some are clearer broadcasters than others. But before I learned how to shield my brain, it was like listening to 10 radio stations at a time. Hard to act normal when all that's going on in your brain, and you're still trying to listen to what people actually say with their mouths. So during that little period of normality, I achieved a measure of peace. I convinced myself that the meeting with Felipe would go well, that he would believe either that we hadn't killed Victor or that Victor's death was justifiable. I was in no hurry to face him to find out. I stayed gossiping at the bar for a few minutes, and on the way home, I filled up the car with gas. I got a chicken sandwich from the Sonic and drove home slowly. Sunset was so late in the summer that the vamps wouldn't be up for a couple of hours yet. I hadn't heard a word from anyone at Fantasia. I didn't even know when I was supposed to get there. I just knew I had to look nice, because Eric would expect it in front of visitors. Dermot wasn't in the house. I'd hoped Claude might have returned from his mysterious trip to Faerie, but if he had, there was no sign. I couldn't spare any more concern for the Fae tonight. I had vampire problems on my mind. I was too anxious to eat more than half my sandwich. I sorted through the mail I'd picked up at the end of the driveway, throwing most of it into the trash can. I had to fish my electric bill out after I tossed it in after a furniture sale flyer. I opened it to check the amount. Claude had better return from Faerie. He was a reckless energy user, and my bill was almost double its normal size. I wanted Claude to pay his share. My water heater was gas, and that bill was way up, too. I put the Shreveport newspaper on the kitchen table to read later. It was sure to be full of bad news. I showered and redid my hair and makeup. It was so hot that I didn't want to wear slacks, and shorts would not suit Eric's sense of formality. I sighed, resigned to the inevitable. I began looking through my summer dresses. Luckily, I'd taken the time to shave my legs, a habit Eric found both fascinating and bizarre. My skin was nice and brown this far into the tanning season, and my hair was a few shades lighter and still looked good from the remedial trim the hairdresser Emmanuel had given it a few weeks previously. I put on a white skirt, a bright blue sleeveless blouse, and a real broad black leather belt that had gotten too tight for Tara. My good black sandals were still in pretty fair shape. My hand paused over the drawer of my dressing table. Within it, camouflaged with a light dusting of face powder, lay a powerful fairy magical object called a Cluvial Door. I'd never thought of carrying it around on my person. Part of me was afraid of wasting the power of the Cluvial Door. If I used it recklessly, it would amount to using a nuclear device to kill a fly. The Cluvial Door was a rare and ancient fairy love gift. I guess it was the Fae equivalent of a Fabergé Easter egg, but magical. My grandfather, not my human one, but my half-human, half-fairy grandfather, Fintan, Dermot's twin, had given it to my grandmother, Adele, who had hidden it away. She had never told me she had it, and I had only just discovered it during the attic clean-out. It had taken me longer to identify it and to learn more about its properties. Only the part-demon lawyer, Desmond Cataliades, knew I had it, though perhaps my friend Amelia suspected, since I'd asked her to teach me about what it could do. Up until now, I'd hidden it just like my grandmother had. You can't go through life carrying a gun in your hand just in case someone wants to attack you, right? Though the Cluvial Door was a love gift, not a weapon, its use might have results just as dramatic. Possession of the Cluvial Door granted the possessor a wish. That wish had to be a personal one, to benefit the possessor or someone the possessor loved. But there were some awful scenarios I'd imagined.
What if I wished an oncoming car wouldn't hit me, and instead it hit another car and killed a whole family? What if I wished that my gran were alive again, and instead of my living grandmother, her corpse appeared? So I understood why Gran had hidden it away from casual discovery. I understood that it had frightened her with its potential, and maybe she hadn't believed that a Christian should use magic to change her own history. On the other hand, the Cluvial Door could have saved Gran's life if she'd had it at the moment she was attacked, but it had been in a secret drawer in an old desk up in the attic, and she had died. It was like paying for a life alert and then leaving it up in the kitchen cabinet out of reach. No one could take it, and it couldn't be used for ill, but then again, it couldn't be used for good either. If making one's wish might lead to catastrophic results, it was almost as perilous to simply possess the Cluvial Door. If anyone, any supernatural, learned I had this amazing object, I would be in even more danger than my normal allotment. I opened the drawer and looked at my grandmother's love gift. The Cluvial Door was a creamy green and looked not unlike a slightly thick powder compact, which was why I kept it in my makeup drawer. The lid was circled with a band of gold. It would not open. It had never opened. I didn't know how to trigger it. In my hand, the Cluvial Door radiated the same warmth I felt when I was close to Niall, the same warmth times 100. I was so tempted to put it in my purse. My hand hovered over it. I took it out of the drawer and turned it over and over in my hands. As I held the smooth object, feeling intense pleasure in its nearness, I weighed the value of taking it with me against the risk. In the end, I put it back in the drawer with a powder puff on top of it. The phone rang. Pam said, "Our meeting is at Eric's house at 9 o'clock. "I thought I'd be coming to Fantasia," I said, a little surprised. "Okay, I'll be on my way in a jiffy." Without answering, Pam hung up. Vampires are not experts on phone manners. I leaned over to look in the mirror while I applied my lipstick. In 2 minutes, the phone rang again. "Hello?"
"Suki,"
said Mustafa's gruff voice.
"You don't need to be here till 10.
"Oh, well, okay." That would give me a more reasonable amount of time. I wouldn't have to risk getting a ticket, and there were a few more little things I'd wanted to do before I left. I said a prayer, and I turned down my bed as a sign of faith that I would return home to sleep in it. I watered my plants, just in case. I quickly checked my email, found nothing of interest. After looking at myself one more time in the full-length mirror on the bathroom door, I decided to leave. I had a comfortable amount of time. I listened to dance music on the way over to Shreveport, and I sang along with songs from Saturday Night Fever. I loved to watch the young John Travolta dance, and that was something I was good at. I could sing only when I was by myself. I belted out "Staying Alive," aware that might be my own theme song. By the time I stopped at the guardhouse at the entrance to Eric's gated community, I was a fraction less worried about the evening. I wondered where Dan Shelley was. The new night guard, a muscular human whose name tag read Vince, waved me through without getting up.
"Enjoy the party," he called.
A little surprised, I smiled and waved back at him. I thought I was going to a serious council, but evidently this visit by the Grand Poobah was starting off on a social note. Though Eric's fancy neighbors on the circle raised their eyebrows at cars parked on the street, I did just that because I didn't want to be blocked in. The broad driveway to the left of the yard, running slightly uphill to Eric's garage, was packed solid. I'd never seen so many cars there. I could hear music coming from the house, though it was faint. Vampires didn't need to turn the volume up like humans did. They could hear all too well. I turned off the motor and sat behind the wheel, trying to get my head together before walking into the lion's den. Why hadn't I just said no when Mustafa told me to come? Until this moment, I literally hadn't considered the option of staying home. Was I here because I loved Eric, or because I was in so deep in the vampire world that it hadn't occurred to me to refuse? Maybe a little of both. I turned to open the Malibu door, and Bill was standing right there. I gave a little yip of shock. "You know better than to do that," I snarled, glad to vent some of my fear in the guise of anger. I shot out of the driver's seat and slammed the door behind me.
"Turn around and go back to Bon Ton, sweetheart," Bill said.
In the harsh street light, my first vampire lover looked horribly white, except for his eyes,
which were shadowed pits. His dark, thick hair and his dark clothing provided even more contrast, so much so that he looked as though he were enameled with luminescent paint, like a house sign.
"I've been sitting in my car thinking about it," I admitted, "but it's too late."
"You should go."
He meant it.
That would be kind of leaving Eric in the lurch, I said, and there might have been a bit of a question in my voice.
"He can manage without you tonight. Please, go home."
Bill's cool hand took mine, and he applied very gentle pressure. "You'd better tell me what's happening."
"Felipe has brought some of his vampires with him. They swept through a bar or two to pick up some humans to drink with, and from. Their behavior is, well, you remember how much Diane, Liam, and Malcolm disgusted you?"
The three vampires, now finally dead, had not had any qualms about having sex with humans in front of me, and it hadn't ended there.
"Yes, I remember."
"Felipe's ordinarily more discreet than that, but he's in a party mood tonight."
I swallowed. "I told Eric I'd come," I said. "Felipe might take it bad if I'm not here, since I'm Eric's human wife."
Eric had coerced me into the title because it gave me a certain amount of protection.
"Eric will survive your absence," Bill said.
If he'd extended that sentence, I was pretty sure the ending would have been, "But you may not survive your presence." He continued,
"I'm stuck out here on guard duty. I'm not allowed inside. I can't protect you."
Leaving the Cluvial door at home had been a mistake.
"Bill, I do pretty good taking care of myself," I said. "You wish me well, you hear?"
"It's okay."
"I have to go in."
"Then I do wish you well."
His voice was wooden, but his eyes were not. I had a choice. I could be formal and go to the front door. A path of stepping stones branched off from the driveway and meandered up the yard to the massive front door. This path was prettily bordered by crepe myrtles, now in full bloom. My other option was to continue up the driveway, swing right into the garage, and enter through the kitchen. That was the one I chose. After all, I was more at home here than any of the Nevada visitors. I strode briskly up the driveway, my heels making a tit-up sound in the quiet night. The kitchen door was unlocked, which was also unusual. I looked around the large and useless kitchen. Someone should be guarding this door, surely, with guests in the house. I finally realized Mustafa Khan was standing at the French windows at the back of the kitchen, past the breakfast table where no one ever ate breakfast. He was looking out into the night.
"Mustafa?" I said.
The daytime man swung around. His very posture was tense. He jerked his chin at me by way of greeting. Despite the hour, Mustafa was wearing his dark glasses. I looked around for his shadow, but there was no Warren in sight. For the first time, I wished I knew what Mustafa was thinking, but his thoughts were as opaque as those of anywhere I'd ever encountered. My skin crawled, but I didn't know why.
"How's it going out there?"
I asked, keeping my voice quiet. After a pause, he answered me, his own voice just as hushed.
"Maybe I should have gotten a job with some freaking goblins, or joined the pack and let Alcide boss me around. That would have been better than this. If I was you, I'd get my ass back in the car and go home. If Eric wasn't paying me so good, that's what I'd do."
This was beginning to sound more and more like the beginning of a fairy tale. First man.
"Don't cross the bridge. It's perilous."
Heroine. "But I must cross the bridge."
Second man. "Upon your life, don't cross the bridge."
Heroine. "But I have to cross the bridge." In a fairy tale, there'd be a third encounter. There are always three, and maybe I would have another one yet. But I'd gotten the idea. Anxiety trickled down my spine like sweat. I sure didn't want to cross that bridge. Maybe I should just ease on down the road? But Pam entered the kitchen, and my opportunity was gone.
"Thank God you're here," she said, her faint British accent more apparent than usual. "I was afraid you weren't going to come. Felipe has noticed you haven't put in an appearance."
"But you changed the time," I replied, puzzled. "Mustafa told me not to be here." I glanced at the clock on the microwave. "Just now."
Pam shook her head, then gave Mustafa a look that seemed more puzzled than irritated.
We'll talk later, she told him.
She made an impatient beckoning gesture to me. I took a second to stow my purse in one of the kitchen cabinets, simply because a kitchen is the safest storage place in a vampire house. Before I followed Pam into the large, open living room dining room area, I fixed a smile on my face. I couldn't help casting a glance over my shoulder at Mustafa, but all I saw was the blankness of the lenses of his dark glasses. I looked ahead of me after that. When you're around vampires, it's always better to have your eye on what's coming. Though Eric's bold decorating had been featured in Louisiana interiors, the photographer would hardly have recognized the room tonight. The striped drapes across the front windows were firmly drawn. There were no fresh flowers. A mixed group of humans and vampires were strewn around the large space. A hugely muscular man with dyed blonde hair was dancing with a young woman to my far left, close to the dining table, which Eric used for business conferences. As I approached, they stopped dancing and started kissing, noisily and with much tongue. A square-jawed male vampire was taking blood from a well-endowed human female on the love seat, and he was making a messy job of it. There were blood drips on the upholstery. Right then, I was pissed off. It added fuel to the flame when I absorbed the fact that a red-haired vamp I didn't know was standing on Eric's coffee table in high heels, dancing to an old Rolling Stones CD. Another vampire with thick black hair was watching her with casual appreciation, as if he'd seen her do the same thing many times but still enjoyed the sight. Her stiletto heels were digging, digging into the wood of the table, one of Eric's favorite acquisitions. I could feel my lips draw in like purse strings. A sideways glance at Pam showed me she was keeping her face as smooth and empty as a pretty bowl. With a huge effort, I wiped my own expression clean. Damn it, we just replaced all the carpeting and had the walls repainted after the Alexei Romanov debacle. Now the upholstery would need to be cleaned again, and I'd have to find someone to refinish the table. I reminded myself I had bigger problems than a few stains and gouges. Bill had been right. Mustafa had been right. This was not a place I should be. Despite what Pam had said, I couldn't believe any of the vampires would have missed me. They were all too busy. But then the man watching the dancer turned his head to look at me. I realized that he was a fully clothed, thank you God, Felipe DeCastro. He smiled at me, his sharp white fangs glistening in the overhead light. Yes, he'd been enjoying the dancing.
Miss Stackhouse, he said lazily, I'd been afraid you wouldn't come tonight. It's been too long since I've had the pleasure of seeing you.
Since Felipe had a thick accent, my name sounded more like Miss Stackhouse. The first time I'd met him, the king had been wearing an honest-to-God cape. Tonight, he dressed conservatively in a gray shirt, silver vest, and black pants. It's been a while, Your Majesty, I said, which was simply all I could think of to say. I'm so sorry I'm a bit late to greet you. Where's Eric?
He's in one of the bedrooms, Felipe said, still smiling.
His mustache and chin strip were perfectly black and perfectly groomed. The king of Nevada, Arkansas, and Louisiana was not a tall man. He was strikingly handsome. He possessed a vitality that was hugely attractive, though not to me, and not tonight. Felipe was also quite the politician, I'd heard, and he was certainly a businessman, no telling how much money he'd amassed in his long life. I smiled back at the king in a frozen way. I was mighty put out. The Nevada visitors weren't acting any better than, say, small-town firemen attending a convention in New Orleans. That these visitors were from Las Vegas and yet felt it necessary to misbehave in Shreveport, well, it didn't speak well for them. In one of the bedrooms didn't sound good, but of course that was what Felipe had intended. I'd better tell him I'm here, I said, and turned to Pam. Let's go, girlfriend. Pam took my hand, and it was a measure of the evening that I actually found that comforting. Her face was still as wax. As we navigated through the room, the muscular man wasn't actually having sex with his companion, but it wasn't far in the future. Pam hissed, Did you see that? The blood will never come out of the upholstery. It won't be as hard to clean up as the night Alexei went nuts here, I said, trying to get perspective. Or the club, after we did that thing. I didn't want to say killed Victor out loud.
But that was fun.
Pam was practically pouting. This isn't for you?
No, I like my pleasures more personal and private.
Oh, me too, I said. Why is Eric back here instead of out there?
I don't know. I just came back from a liquor run, she said briefly. Mustafa insisted we needed some more rum.
She was doing Mustafa's bidding now? But I pressed my lips shut. It was no business of mine. By that time, we'd reached the door of the bedroom I used at Eric's, since I didn't want to be shut downstairs with him all day in his light-tight sleeping room. Pam, a step ahead of me, pushed open the door and stiffened. Eric was there, and he was sitting on the bed, but he was feeding off someone, a dark-haired woman. She was sprawled across his lap, her bright summer dress twisted around her body, one hand gripping his shoulder and kneading it while he sucked from her neck. Her other hand was... she was pleasuring herself.
You asshole, I said, and I reversed on the spot.
Getting the hell out of there was my all-consuming desire. Eric raised his head, his mouth bloody, and his eyes met mine. He was drunk.
You can't go, Pam said.
She gripped my arm now, and I could tell it would break before she'd release me.
If you run out now, we'll look weak, and Felipe will react. We'll all suffer. Something's wrong with Eric.
I really don't give a damn, I told her. My head felt oddly light and distant from the shock. I wondered if I would faint or throw up or leap on Eric and choke him.
You need to leave, Eric told the woman.
His words were slurred.
What the hell?
But we were just getting around to the good part, she said in what she thought was a seductive voice. Don't make me go, baby, before the big payoff. If you want her to join in, that's all right with me, sugar.
It took all her effort to get the words out. She was white as a sheet. She'd lost a lot of blood.
You must go, Eric said, a bit more clearly.
His voice had the shove in it vampires use to get humans moving. Though I refused to look at the brunette, I knew when she got off the bed, and Eric. I knew when she staggered and almost fell.
Now I can keep my car, she thought.
I was so startled to hear this that I turned to look at her. She was younger than me, and she was skinny. Somehow that made Eric's offense worse. After a second, I could glimpse, past my agitation, that she had a lot of sickness in her head. The stuff churning around in her mind was both awful and confusing. Self-loathing made her thoughts all tinged with gray, as if she were rotting from her core out. The surface still looked pretty, but it wouldn't be for long. The girl also had Tui blood, though I couldn't tell what kind, maybe werewolf. One of her parents was the real deal. That made sense, given Eric's condition. Tui blood packed a punch for vampires, and she'd amped it up somehow to make herself more intoxicating. Pam said,
I don't know who you are or how you got in here, girl, but you must leave now.
The girl laughed, which neither Pam nor I had expected. Pam jerked, and I felt a solar flare go off in my head. I'd added rage to disgust. Laughing! My eyes met the girl's. The smirk vanished from her lips, and she blanched. I was no vampire, but I guess I looked pretty threatening.
All right, I'm going. I'll be out of Shreveport by dawn.
She was lying. She decided to make one last attempt to... what? She sneered at me and said deliberately,
It ain't my fault that your man was hungry.
Before I could move, Pam backhanded her. The girl lurched against the wall, then slid to the ground.
Get up,
Pam said, her voice deadly. With visible effort, the girl rose to her feet. There were no more smiles or provocative statements. She passed close to me as she left the room, and I smelled her. Not only a trace of Tui, but another scent, blood with a sweet undertone. She made her way down the hall and out to the living room, supporting herself with one hand against the wall. After she'd cleared the door, Pam shut it. The room was oddly quiet. My brain was running in 100 different directions. From my late arrival, to the new guard at the gate, to the strange thoughts I'd read from the girl, the odd scent I'd caught when she was near, and then my whole focus fell on a different subject, my husband.
Eric still remained sitting on the side of the bed. The bed I thought of as mine. The bed where we had sex. The bed where I slept. He spoke directly to me.
You know I take blood, he began, but I held up a hand.
Don't speak, I said. He looked indignant, and his mouth opened, and I said again, don't speak. Seriously, if I could have gotten away by myself for 30 minutes, or 30 hours, or 30 days, I could have dealt with the situation. As it was, I had to do a speed speech in my head. I knew I wasn't Eric's only drinking fountain. One person could not be the sole food source for a vampire, or rather, not for a vampire who doesn't supplement with synthetic. Not his fault, he needed food, blah, blah. When it's freely offered, why not take it, blah, blah. But he knew I was due to arrive. He knew I would let him drink. He knew the fact that he chose to drink from another woman would hurt me deeply. And he did it anyway. Unless there was something I didn't know about this woman, or something she'd done to Eric that had triggered this reaction, this signaled that he didn't care about me as deeply as I'd always thought. I could only think, thank God I broke the blood bond. If I'd felt his enjoyment while he was sucking on her, I'd have wanted to kill him. Eric said,
if you hadn't broken our blood bond, this would never have happened.
I had another solar flare in my head. This is why I don't carry a stake, I muttered, and swore long and fluently to myself. I hadn't told Pam not to speak. After eyeing me intently to assess my mood, she said,
you know that in a while you'll adjust. This was a question of timing, not of unfaithfulness.
After I took a long moment to resent the hell out of her conviction that I was going to accommodate Eric's behavior, I had to nod. I wasn't necessarily agreeing with the premise behind her words, that when I'd calmed down I wouldn't mind what Eric had done. I was simply acknowledging the fact that she had a point. Though it made me scream inside, I pushed aside all the things I wanted to say to Eric, because something more urgent was happening here. Even I could see that. Listen, here's the important stuff, I said, and Pam nodded. Eric looked surprised, and his back stiffened. He looked more like himself, more alert and intelligent. That girl didn't just wander in here out of the blue. She was sent, I said. The vampires looked at each other. They shrugged simultaneously.
I'd never seen her before,
Eric said.
I thought she came in with Felipe's pickups, Pam said.
There's a new guy at the gate. I looked from one to the other. Where'd Dan Shelley go, tonight of all nights? And after Pam called me and told me to be here at 9, Mustafa called me right back and told me to be here an hour later. Eric, I'm sure that girl tasted different to you?
Yes, he said, nodding slowly. I'm still feeling the effects. She was extra.
Like she'd had some kind of supplement? I suppressed another surge of hurt and anger.
Yes,
he agreed. He got up, but I could see that standing wasn't easy.
Yes, as if she'd had a Ware and Fairy cocktail.
His eyes closed.
Delicious,